This is the Commercial Property Investing Explained series, brought to you by Steve Polisi. Find out how commercial property really works and start investing like the pros. Your education starts now. Welcome to the Commercial Property Investing Explained series, where we have a little bit of a different style show for you today. I actually have two gentlemen with me, one being my trusty co-host, Steve Polisi. How are you, mate?
Good, mate. How are you doing? Ready to crush the next guest?
I am. Very, very good. And the other gentleman we have is none other than Joe Tucker. How are you, mate?
I am good, mate. This is an unfair fight. I've come onto a show called Commercial Property Explained, and I'm trying to defend myself against two commercial property experts, but I've got residential on my side, and that's all we need. So I'm excited for this one.
No need to panic, Joe. I've already said to Andrew, anytime you beat me in an argument, we're cutting that, leaving it on the editing floor and making cricket sounds.
So, Joe, you have definitely walked into the wolf's den on this one, mate, but I'm going to keep it as fair and impartial as possible on my behalf. So today we are actually going to be having a debate-style battle royale, if you will, about which investments, residential property or commercial property, is better to go for. So Joe will be defending the residential property side and Steve will be defending the commercial property side. And before we jump into it, I just wanted to give a full disclaimer. Both of the fighters here today, if you will be using the context of this debate to push an argument that they might not really believe or have like a true conviction in their personal life. We are purely doing this for entertainment and a debate style. So Steve will be taking the commercial side and Joe will be taking the residential side. So that's pretty much how it is. So if Joe does say things that are blasphemy, don't kill him for it in his personal life, because I'm sure it's not 100% true.
All of the facts will be true, but my thoughts on commercial property is that it should be a part of everyone's portfolio, mainly towards the end of your investing rather than at the beginning. But yes, commercial is definitely going to be a part of my property story. So I do agree.
Well, I disagree. Commercial is way better. So sorry, Joe, you're going to lose space.
So just before we get into it, so I'm speaking for both of them. All of us believe that residential and commercial property are great investments. Hands down, best investments in the world. So just so we get that on the table. But the way this podcast is going to flow is we're going to have some topics. There's going to be an opening argument, which each fighter will have 3 minutes for each for their opening argument. And then we're going to go into the topics, which are purpose of the investment, capital required, risk, cash flow, capital growth, exit strategies, and scalability. And then after we finish going through all of those topics, there's going to be a rebuttal for each single topic after we go through it. And then once we have finished that, there'll be a conclusion. There's also going to be a secret question that I'm going to ask each of the fighters at the end, which they do not know what this question is. And I will get to the bottom of whether or not they are residential or commercial investors. But that's pretty much it. And humor is encouraged. If they can make me laugh, they'll get extra points that don't really count or don't really matter. But, you know, it'll go in their favor and make it a lot more fun to do it. So let's get into it, boys. Any last words?
No, I haven't even bothered preparing for this, Andrew. Like, I know I'm going to crush Joe. I've just spent the last 3 hours trying to think of insults for him, but he's actually got a really tough name. Like, Joe Tucker rhymes with nothing. Like, Bucker, no. Clucker. Like, what do you rhyme Tucker with?
You can't.
There's a word that begins with F that I can think of, but you know, it's probably not friendly for this podcast.
No. In all serious, like, I like Joe, but he probably should say goodbye to his loved ones because he's not going to be able to show his face after this.
Well, the problem is, Steve, you have already got a professional fight under your belt there in the real world as well. So that's a little concerning.
I knocked him out in a minute as well, Joe. So this is going to be a short podcast.
Well, hopefully I'm a more worthy adversary. So let's crack on. Rezzy is on my corner. I'll be fine. We don't have a white towel to throw in.
All right.
Let's get ready to rumble.
All right, boys, let's get into this. In the red corner, we have the founder of Property Principles. He is half owner of the 67,000 Facebook group Oz Property. He's standing at 184 centimeters tall, weighing in at 90 kilos. With his most embarrassing favorite hobby is he likes to make puzzles in his pastime. It is Joe the Mo Tucker, a.k.a. the Resonator.
The Resonator. I love the Resonator. I'll take that.
And in the blue corner, he is the founder of Polisi Property. He has written the best-selling book, Commercial Property Explained Simply. He's standing at 193 centimeters tall, weighing in at 83 kilos. His most embarrassing hobby is watching magician secrets revealed on YouTube. It's the Ibis, a.k.a. the bearded bin chicken.
I actually do get called at my gym the Ibis because I've got a big nose, skinny legs, and a big torso.
Awesome, guys. We are going to scissor, paper, rocket for the first opening argument, if you guys would like to indulge me.
All right. My ready? Camera's got a delay, so I'll be able to win this one.
All right. 3, 2, 1.
Yeah. What did you show, Steve? What did you show? I didn't, see it. Oh, scissor. Oh. Scissor. I don't know if Steve really showed scissor. He showed it off the camera.
That's a great idea.
It's all the magician's secrets.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Steve, you could choose first. You want to go first or you want to go second?
I'll go first.
So we're going to start with your opening argument, why commercial property is the better investment. You got 3 minutes.
Commercial's better for multiple reasons. You can basically, you don't have a glass ceiling with lending, the same as residential. You get 3 times the cash flow and you get exactly the same capital growth. So anything Joe can do with resi, I can do 3 times faster and with 3 times the cash flow. So when he's talking about his 30-year retirement plans, we're talking 10-year retirement plans, and we've got more value add options. So we can actually accelerate that even faster without resi. So all those combined, commercial easily the front runner over resi.
Perfect. I like it. All right. That was a nice quick 35 seconds. All right, Joe. Joe.
Drag that out in post. Yeah.
Joe, let's hear your opening argument.
Well, I do love a good commercial property, but you cannot go past residential. It is far more stable. It is a low barrier to entry. Any mum and dad investor can get out there. You can buy a $300,000 property. You can buy $1 million property and you can get amazing capital growth. You also have shorter lease terms, usually. So you have longer lease terms in commercial property, but it allows us to, as the market expands, get better rents for it. We're less volatile. We don't rely so much on the Australian economy because everyone needs a house. Everyone needs to live somewhere. So it's far more stable. The rental yields are incredibly strong. Capital growth is incredibly strong. The lending situation is a lot easier. My first property, I bought it with 105% LVR. I didn't put any cash into it. So you can get better mortgage rates. You can get better facilities attached to those. And it's a far larger market. It's a far bigger pool of people. We've got both 70% owner occupiers. We've got 30% investors. That gives us far more scope for good deals, but also when we need to sell, we've got some flexibility in that. And you can start small. You don't need to have $1 million set up already like you may need in the commercial space. So for me, residential's a key to investing. Without residential, you cannot get to commercial. So that's my closing argument, or starting one.
Oh, he's good, Andrew. He's good.
I like it. That was pretty convincing. All right, all right. So we'll go into the first topic. Both had very, very good opening arguments. Steve, it's on you. The purpose of the investment, is there a lifestyle factor? Why would you invest in commercial property?
Yeah. So for me, like the only reason you buy a commercial is lifestyle. Like you actually get to build a lifestyle faster than residential. And that comes with the cash flow. And that's what most of the clients I speak to actually want. Like you can have a good retirement for residential, but you're not going to have a great retirement. Like you might get to the end of your 30 years and be like, oh, cool. I've got a $35,000 passive income. Cool. You can go get over on toast once a day and your coffee and that's pretty much it. But commercial, because I was mentioning in the opening argument, you get 2 to 3 to 4 times the cash flow. You can actually have a substantial retirement sooner. And that's what most people want. The new day and age, gone are the days of effectively working for 30 years for the same company to have an okay retirement. Young people want to travel, they want to do things, they want to change jobs. It gives them the lifestyle to actually be able to change that in a short amount of time. And that's why you buy commercial. It gives you actual lifestyle.
Perfect. I like it. We're going to give Joe a chance to have a rebuttal on that after his opening statements on the purpose of the investment. All right, Joe, you're on.
So the purpose of the investment is capital growth and cash flow. That's why we invest in property to start with. We want a return on investment. But you can't start in commercial property. You need to start in residential and you've got to build up to that. So if you are young, if you're 24, maybe commercial, you're not going to be able to get to that lifestyle age because you're going to need $1 million to start off initially. So residential is get rich slow. Shows you at any investing, really. It is all compounded slowly. But for residential, you can get capital growth. You can get cash flow. You can add value to be able to get cash flow. But the focus is capital growth. That's what we really, really want. That's what you should be aiming for, residential property. When you try and go super duper cash flow, it does become a challenge to get cash flow returns. So for a lifestyle factor, you've got to build it. It takes time. To create anything worthwhile is going to take time. So it's not a quick fix.
All right, Stevie, do you have anything to rebut against that?
He basically argued my point. Who wants to wait a long time to actually be wealthy, Joe? Like, put it all in Bitcoin and all in commercial property. Nothing can go wrong. Retire in the next 5 years, done. But no, in all seriousness, any of those arguments you can counteract with, like, the low entry point. You can buy a car spot for $20,000 if you want. You can't buy a house. So there are some low entry points. The next topic, which I'll save where we get into the amount of capital, we'll talk about that. But you can effectively get that cash flow and into the market sooner. Not everyone has bank of mum and dad like Joe and can get 105% loans with parental guarantees. So, but for the Aussie battler, I'm an every person's man. You can get into it like everyone else.
All right. So my question to Joe, his main points was capital growth, one of them. And I want to ask Joe, do you not think it's possible for commercial property to have significant capital growth?
Definitely. You can get capital growth in commercial property, but it's not as strong. It just isn't as strong as it is in residential. Over time, eventually, it will catch up. Like if you set up a lease, what happens with a lease that you set up on a 3x3x3? How do you get value increase? Like, let's say you're not going to add value yourself. You're not going to change a car spot and open it up. How do you get the capital value to increase?
You can have that in the lease, Joe. You can actually have fixed 5, 7, 10% rental increases, which because of the cap rate equates to capital growth. So you can almost calculate your capital growth. Whereas with residential, my rent went up $100 a week. The property's not worth anymore. So the capital growth, I agree with Joe, in certain asset classes, you don't get the same. So an office space does not grow the same as a house, but neither does a high density off the plan apartment. So because you're paying a lot of money for a contract in the sky. So you need that scarcity factor. But as long as you're getting the land component in the same area that the residential's growing, you should get exactly the same. And the way I always argue this is if residential had more capital growth, like even a percentage, 1% or 2% more per year, why is it not more expensive than commercial? Joe just said, oh, it's a harder entry price to get in for commercial. How did commercial get more expensive if it's had less capital growth?
So why are the yields better in commercial? How does it work? How come it's more expensive and you get better yields?
No one actually knows, but my rationality behind it is just because it's less understood. So because there are way more moving parts in commercial, there's a premium for that. No one's going to take on this a little bit more risk than residential and not get a return. And so that's risk assessing the market. And people say, okay, this, I want to get 2 to 3 times the cash to mitigate that risk. And sort of like you said, there's a misconception about the capital growth. So some investors actually think if I buy this commercial, I'm not going to get the same capital growth. So I want to counteract that by getting more cash flow.
Yeah. Well, what you just said there was the answer, right? It was risk. Because you are taking on a bigger risk in a commercial property purchase. In residential, there is a lot less risk associated to it, which makes investors feel a lot more comfortable. So they're willing to accept a lower rental yield. But also I look at the actual numbers, right? I was looking at some numbers before this, looking at a suburb called Crestmead. Let's say you have a 3-year lease locked in at inflation adjusted return. What would that lease look like? Would it be like $500? Let's just say $500 a week and inflation adjusted. How much is inflation adjusted? What does that actually mean in the dollar terms and the percent terms?
Well, it depends what inflation is, but at the moment it's kind of like 7%. So you do your market reviews at each time, or it can be fixed and go from there. But you actually mentioned as well about the risk. I'd actually argue, yes, and this is because we're knowledgeable investors, so we don't kind of make mistakes. But you know, like I've had so many clients call me and they tell me about like a high density apartment they bought in Perth that's worth less, or I got sucked in and I bought a mining town because it had higher cash and things like that. So there are risks in residential. The thing is with commercial is people have a little bit of knowledge, and as long as like they live in a normal kind of area. And what I mean by that is just like something that's very stereotypical, suburbia, 3-4-bedroom house. They know where the work is, where the bus stops, train stations are, things like that. Yes, they probably are likely to get less burnt. Whereas unless someone's buying a warehouse where they live, they don't really understand. Like retail has a different risk profile to office space compared to industrial. But like at the moment, industrial vacancy rates in every capital city are sub 0.7%. So you can actually buy some very low risk ones. But I do agree, if you buy a very vanilla residential property, there's less moving parts and less things to stuff up on. You can still go, you go buy Brisbane, you can still buy in a flood zone and have your house flooded in 5 years.
Yeah, I agree. The other point that I wanted to make is the shorter lease terms for residential, which is super useful for where, like right now, we're in Australia, we are in a current rental crisis. So rent right now, I've looked up a suburb called Crestmead, right? This is in Brisbane. I just grabbed a random one. Rent has increased 3% in the last 3 months. It's increased 12% in the last 12 months, and it's increased 41% in the last 3 years. So you're 7 a year, 7, 14, 21. I'm 44% growth on this. So you can, having a shorter lease term allows you a little bit more flexibility to increase the rent as it goes up in the market. If you're locked in at 3 years, you can't shift anything except for what's built in. That's a little bit of an advantage. You can obviously create shorter leases and do all that kind of stuff in the commercial space, but it's generally a 3 or 5 year lease.
I agree with the premise of that, but you can also have compressing of cap rates. What I was saying is you can plan for your capital growth. You can still get more. We've still seen 30% capital increase in like even warehouses in Crestmead. So they've seen that as well. So you get the best of both worlds. But thanks for that, Joe. I've actually owned a property in the two adjoining suburbs in Eagleby and Waterford West. And yep, I've had about 40% capital growth in the last few years as well.
All right. So I just wanted to remind you guys, let's stay on topic per topic. Let's not go outside of the...
Oh, shut up, ref. Go mind your business.
...of the actual topic, because we were going to be talking about risk later on, and now we're going to have to repeat that. So let's stick on topic. And I do want to just touch base on, Joe asked why commercial property has higher yields. And I can give you the clear cut answer to that. It's because commercial property is designed for an investor to have a return. That's the purpose of the vehicle. But residential property is not designed for investors. It's designed to have a home for someone to live. But investors use that to try and get cash flow. So its primary purpose is shelter. And the primary purpose of commercial property to purchase it is for an investment. So an investor will need a return to be able to go into that property, because no one's going to live in a commercial property except if it's for your business.
Yeah. So I agree with you, Andrew, like, because we obviously look at investment grade properties. That's what we buy. The government still obviously look for owner occupied commercial property as well. So they'll build warehouses. But again, it's to make a profit. It's so the government can charge their GST and those businesses can pay tax and they make money that way. So it's still got the same kind of dynamic of owner occupier and investor. But like you said, the whole premise is to actually help the residential market as well, build the population, build the wages, get the tax.
Yeah, but traditionally, like the way that a property is built, it's not like when it was first made up, it's not for investors to make money from. It's for owners to buy it, to get you indebted to the bank, to keep you paying a mortgage for the rest of your life, to keep you as an employee. That's what it's for. All right, so let's move on. We need to give Joe a chance to rebut against Steve, against his argument. But who knows if Joe even remembers what he said.
Argument? I can't remember what we're talking about.
His points were commercial property gives you lifestyle and it also gives you passive income. That's the purpose of the investment.
Good.
All right, no rebuttal. All right, Steve, I'm going to ask you a question. How much passive income can we expect? How easily can we create passive income? Everyone talks about passive income. Is it really passive?
Yeah, so nothing's actually passive, because at some point you're going to either have to get a buyer's agent or do your research and find something yourself. And then there'll be speed bumps along the way with like changing of tenants and then slipping back on payments, etc. So I'm not sugarcoating it, but the example I always use on these podcasts and sales calls, et cetera, is let's just say we buy $1 million property on a 6% net yield. And then typically we're seeing every 10 to 15 years, the rents double. So that $60,000 is actually going to go to $120,000. If you put that cash flow back into the property, you can actually have it paid off in 15 years very easily. And then at the end of that, you've actually got $120,000 passive income from one $1 million property. So you buy $1 million residential property, it takes you 15 to 30 years minimum to pay it off. And then you're going to end up with what, maybe a $60,000 maximum income. And that's not including council rates, water rates, maintenance, and all those ones, which commercial obviously covers. So it can generally actually build you quite simply $50,000, $100,000, $150,000 passive income just for mum and dad investors. But residential, you're lucky to get $20,000, $30,000 over 10, 20 years.
Yeah, because that's in your example, you're not using residential to its maximum potential, right? You're just saying, oh, we'll just get the rental income from it. You're not getting creative and paying down the debt or investing, utilizing the equity that we have in that home to buy another property, which is then going to enhance the portfolio and grow bigger to be able to eventually get to those returns. So you can still get your lifestyle. You can actually build a property portfolio over the next 30 years in residential and be cash flow positive over $120,000 annually, inflation adjusted. So you can still get your capital growth and your cash flow from residential. It's just done in a different way rather than simply explaining, great, we just buy your commercial, you just pay it down, it does its thing. Yes, that's the way it works in commercial, but you can expand your portfolio and get your residential to that point as well. There's a couple more steps, but again, risk adjusted. You do have to take on some bigger risks in the commercial.
With residential, when you've got lots of properties and susceptible to interest rate changes and different properties and huge maintenance bills. Cool, I agree. Yeah, very slow and boring, Joe. Well done.
What are you talking about? The reason you buy commercial is the difference, the spread between the interest rate and the net yield that you're getting. So as interest rates compress that spread, commercial becomes far more unattractive. Obviously, if you've got an unencumbered, you know, you've got no debt on it, it's far more, you know, that doesn't matter. That's fine. You're sorted. But as interest rates increase, that makes commercial, every time an interest rate increases, it makes it a lot less attractive. In the residential space, property prices, interest rates have gone up 13 times and property prices have done nothing but increase and vacancy rates have dropped. It's easier to buy. It's harder to get a rental. You're getting paid.
That sounds way riskier to me. If I buy a $1 million commercial and let's say after the difference, the spread that you're mentioning is say $20,000 and interest rates go up and then that goes to zero, for me, that is way lower risk than buying a $1 million residential that costs me $30,000 a year that then goes to $50,000 a year. And with your argument, if I own two or three of those, I'm stitching myself up there, putting myself at huge financial risk.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on to the next topic. I think we've covered the purpose of the investment. All right, next topic is the capital required. What are the barriers to entry? Steve, you're off.
So am I going first every time? Am I? All right, let's do this. All right, so Joe's going to say, I've got bank of mum and dad. I can get 105% loans. He is also going, I'm going to M&M you in 8 Mile here. I'm just going to basically say your answer. He's also going to say, I can get 90% loans, 95% loans. And you are 100% correct. My counter argument to that is, so the maximum you can typically get with commercial, unless you're obviously refinancing another property, is 80%. So at the moment, there's a few lenders doing it, Suncorp, BOQ, ANZ, Liberty. You can get 80% loans on long loan terms, 15 to 30 year, the same full doc loans. My argument to that is because of the cash flow, we can actually make up that deposit difference in the next few years. So where, say, we're buying a $500 or $1 million property and it's 20, 30 grand a year positive, within a few more years, we've actually made up that extra 10% that you might have got in residential. And we know we can calculate it. So we can actually calculate when we can get into the next property. Whereas with residential, if it's neutral or negative, you are purely banking on the capital growth to get into the next property. If that doesn't happen, like I agree, if you get the capital and it's leveraged 90%, you can get into the next property quicker. And that's the whole aim of commercial, is trying to get the cash flow and the capital growth if you're in the foundation stages. So you either do that through fabricating equity, which Andrew loves, is the kind of uplift that way, or you do it just by buying a good bulletproof blue chip property.
Okay. Good arguments. All right, Joe, over to you.
Solid arguments. Let's say we're going back to your example of your million-dollar property that's going to give you 20 grand of cash flow. How much capital do I need to buy that at an 80% LVR?
So you're typically with the 5% purchasing cost, so stamp duty 3.4, 3.5% plus other purchasing about 5%. So let's say 250 grand to get into that property.
That's a big barrier for not everyone, but a lot of people cannot afford $250,000 to be able to get into a commercial property. So you say like the bank of mum and dad. Well, yeah, there's no such thing as a $250,000 bank of mum and dad. There's no way you're going to be able to get any help up from that side of things. So for me, getting access to capital is what you need. And the way to do that, to quickly grow capital, is, as Steve mentioned, crypto. You can do that. Or you can re-leverage into something a little bit more stable, like residential property. Commercial property, all these values come from growing a residential property portfolio initially, because you've got to build that capital base first. So without residential, commercial property wouldn't even exist at such, you know, obviously it would exist physically, but you need as an investor to build up that capital growth. So if you have a $500,000 property, $500,000, and they double in value in 10 years, you've then got $1.5 million that you can then convert and get your cash flow. So I think it's not more of a which one is better, it's more of a timing. When can you actually afford to get into the commercial? If you go and have $100,000 right now, can I get in? No. Okay, how long does it take to save up $100,000? Well, it takes very, very long. How long does it save up $250,000? Much longer. So you can't get in to commercial property. It's just not reachable. It's not affordable for the everyday mum and dad. How many of the investors that you talk to, guys, on every single day, how many of them percentage-wise don't have a property portfolio and start investing in commercial property?
He's good, Andrew. He's good. Nah, but I'm being facetious. In all seriousness for the listeners, Joe is right. The whole power of property is leveraging. And you can get more leverage. So depending on where you are in your portfolio, it can make sense to actually leverage into residential first. Because if, like Joe said, if you can have 50% larger or even 200% larger portfolio, because you get two properties on 90% loans versus one on the 80%, and we do get the same capital growth. So say we actually agree and we get the same capital growth, not more or less, Joe actually makes twice as much capital, which then he can deploy into another property sooner. So it's about matching up on our first argument point about what the purpose of the investment is. Is it to get into the next one, or is it to build a passive income? And then you kind of match that up with what you've got to work with finance.
Also, yeah, that's actually a really good point. The other point that I think is important to note is, like, the way it works is you've like a pair of scales. You've got cash and equity on one side, and you've got borrowing ability and serviceability on the other. Your job as an investor is to say, I want to purchase another property, but I want to make sure that this next property purchase is not going to outweigh one of the scales, so I can't get into the next one. So this might actually be a conversation that you need to have with somebody and say, okay, well, I'm kind of maxed out. I'm almost maxed out on my serviceability. How do I make sure that I can get something that might need a little bit more cash flow to lift this up? Because I've got a lot of cash and equity. Or it might be, hey, the barrier to entry for commercial is up here. I'm not at that level yet. What are my options? What are my choices? Great. You're then stuck and forced to go into the residential space.
Yeah, the three questions I always ask on every sales call with a new client is what we're actually trying to achieve over what time frame versus what we have to work with. So what I mean by what we have to work with is finance, because that can sometimes dictate it. If the broker comes back and says, look, Joe, you're actually good for $1.3 million for residential or $750,000 commercial, cool. There's an argument that we need to kind of match it up. But if you're a 65-year-old client and you want retirement, even though I might have more leverage in the residential space, it's not getting to what we're trying to achieve in the time frame. So it's kind of matching up that. And that's where your argument of, cool, use leverage when it's there. When it's not there, we're going to move into other avenues and self-storage, Andrew, and commercial. And there's a mix as well. You can go high-yielding residential. That's an argument as well. And then that sometimes shifts into commercial anyway, like a whole block of apartments is a commercial investment.
All right, I just want to remind Steve to stay in character, mate, or you will be disqualified. Do not agree with Joe. That's ridiculous.
That's a load.
All right.
Shut up, Raph. Shut up, Raph.
So, Joe, no, I did have Raph. One question for you. You did mention barrier to entry. Now, when you're investing, having a moat around the investment, as in a barrier to entry, can be seen as a good thing. Are you sure that's not good for there to be a higher barrier to entry so there is easier ways or more or less people in the space.
Yeah, it's great for the rich. Absolutely. A high barrier to entry is great for the rich people, but I don't deal with rich people. I deal with everyday Australians that are trying to make stuff happen. So you guys, you know, you sit in your ivory towers with all your rich clients and all your commercial properties, but I'm talking to the real people that want to get to that point. So we're getting them there, but it does take a little bit of time. So yeah, high barrier to entry is great for you guys.
Okay, okay.
I'll actually help Joe here. I'm gonna throw him a
You'll be disqualified.
Having low barrier to entry actually means there's also more buyers as well, which can actually also increase demand. I can argue, obviously, with the moat around the property that having less means there's more demand for it as well. But having 20 people turn up to an open home is always going to push up prices.
Yeah, I know we're probably going to get to this, but is the emotional element as well with capital growth? The way that you choose a residential property is based on owner-occupier appeal as well. That's a big factor that's included. I went to an open home that was beautiful, beautiful open for inspection. They did the styling. They made it incredible. My walk-away price was $640,000 for this property. Unreal deal. If we could get it for that, we would have been very happy. But what happened is emotional owner-occupiers, first home buyers, and banks and mom and dad came in and got far too emotional. They paid $740,000 of it. So we walked away from that deal, and that's what you should do as an investor. Set your financial limit and don't let emotions come in and then walk away. You don't have that in the commercial space. That's a good thing, but it's also a bad thing because you're not getting that extra capital growth. I think that's a worthwhile point noting as well.
Okay, fair enough. I like it. I like it. All right, let's move on to the next topic, which is risk. Which asset carries more risk associated with it? Stevie?
All right, so perceived value for commercial is it takes more risk. However, I actually always say, my book's literally called Explain Simply, is there's not more risk, there's just more steps. So it's like walking up a staircase isn't hard. You just have to take one step at a time. Jumping up a staircase is obviously hard, but if you go to policyproperty.com and download the due diligence checklist for free, it walks you through it. But in saying that though, it depends on what you're buying, but if you know what you're doing with commercial, you can actually buy lower risk ones. And I sort of alluded to it before with some of the like the fluctuations of like interest rates, how you're less susceptible to that because the property is cash flow positive. It's not going to take out of your back pocket as much as residential. The other one is you can actually save buffers a lot easier. So having, I'll go back to, we'll keep using the $1 million example. So it's 20 grand a year positive. I can say I've got a 5-year lease, and at the end of the 5 years, I'm worried that the tenant might leave. I can then have $100,000 sitting there and I'm kind of guaranteed. So if anything goes wrong, I can handle a few years vacancy, things like that. Whereas with residential, it's 30 grand or so negative. So I need to keep working, keep paying that down. And then I'm susceptible to things like the air conditioner breaking, hot water system, the roof leaking, which is additional bills. So I can get to the end of the 5 years and actually be down $150,000. So that's kind of locking me into the actual work culture of trying to keep that property. So I'd argue that the cash flow actually reduces some of the risk with commercial. But the hard thing is choosing the low risk commercial. Don't go out, same concept as residential. Don't go out and buy in a little 20,000 person town thinking you're going to be fine with vacancy rates and things like that. If you buy a really tightly held area with a good residential kind of surrounding it and tight vacancy rates and good demand, you can buy very low risk commercials.
Okay, we're talking about risk here. So life's changed, right? I'm a normal everyday person. Something's happened in my life. I need to get out. How do I do that in commercial? How long does it take to sell a property and move it on to the next buyer?
At the moment, not that much longer than a residential. So you're going to tell me there's properties that you're looking at in Adelaide and Perth, et cetera, that are 3 days, 4 days on market. Some markets we're looking at is 7 to 14 days is typically under contract. Not because there's not buyers ready, just because there's a little bit more work to do involved of reviewing things and leases and inspections and things like that. But the market where we're buying, same as residential, is hot and short days on market.
And what about vacancy times? Like, let's just say you lose a tenant, because with a residential, we all know how it works, right? Tenant leaves, you advertise it on realestate.com and you get a new person. You move out their stuff, bring in the new stuff. You find a commercial, let's say you have a cafe and it's been 5 years, that ends. How long does it take to get that tenancy, get a new person back in, get their logos, design, all that stuff up there and running so that you can get your rent?
Yeah. So case by case, depends on the type of asset, where you're buying. Certain assets like Northern Beaches, where I live, industrial warehouses have a 0% vacancy rate. The counter argument to you is I actually get 6 months notice when my tenant's leaving. You get what, a month? So I can actually prepare for that time. I agree. If you're buying something like a cafe or retail, might be longer vacancy. In a good area, 1 to 3 months is a tight vacancy. Like that's good. And if it's a bad area, it can be years. And then you have to give them incentive before they rent on. But then typically they're locked into that location because they look after the maintenance. The success of their business is locked in there. Whereas your residential tenants are grubby, scuffing up the carpet, pooping on the walls, and then you got to kick them out, go to the tribunal. Commercial property, if they're bad tenants, you change the locks, which Andrew's done recently on one of his self-storage ones, get them out and move on.
We have a nice big driveway out the front of our commercial plate. We got like car spaces and all of that. What happens when a big crack comes up the concrete? Who's responsible for, you know, a $300,000 driveway car park?
Yeah. So sometimes in the lease, they'll obviously to cover the maintenance. I'm going to assume you're talking about freestanding because then, yes, that would pass on to the owner. Typically, sometimes there's a to and fro with the tenant because like they may have caused it, for instance. Yeah. So like one of my properties, the tenant actually backed into the roller door. They covered that, for instance, because they caused it. So it depends on who caused it. Arguably, if you're buying, say, a body corporate warehouse, I'd actually say there's a level of kind of like assurance that you're not going to be stung because as long as you assess the body corporate, I might buy a $500,000, $600,000 warehouse and there's $300,000 in the admin and sinking fund. So if that happens, the admin and sinking fund cover it. Or if the roof starts leaking, for instance, there's a layer of protection there as well.
So the answer is if your cafe has a car park and there's a big crack up it and it's going to cost $300,000 and you're the one that needs to pay for it. That's the answer.
For freestanding, but no different to residential.
Yeah, but we don't have a $300,000 car park. We've got a $10,000 driveway. So there is a lot more risk associated with that. Well, you've got to be able to have some capital there because if you can't fix that driveway and you break your lease, you then lose a tenant, you then lost $300,000. And you have to fix the issue and you don't have the capital. And then who is going to buy a commercial property with a broken thing that needs to spend $300,000
on? Your assumption is we're buying a commercial that's way more value than residential. Like what if it's a cafe that's a standard house? So it's a standard residential property house that's got zoned for being a cafe. Then it's exactly the same. It's a like-for-like argument. The benefit of my cafe that's a house is when the hot water system goes, when the air conditioning goes, when the walls need painting, my cafe, the tenant actually completely rendered the outside of the building and painted it for me and I didn't have to pay a cent. So there's those added advantages as well. But I agree, if you're up on your throne like me and Andrew on our ivory tower and you own the bigger ones, there are bigger risks with that, but you're not buying that asset unless you've obviously got the extra capital for it.
Yeah, going down to capital, you got to be the ivory tower boys. Not saying that that's a bad thing. Everyone is at a certain point, and that's why you're listening to this show, is to grow and get yourself to that next level. So congratulations on making it this far as well.
So, if you're still listening to us, you've got bigger problems.
So what I think is actually happening is Joe's actually just rebutted Steve just straight up. I didn't hear any like pros on why residential is actually lower risk. It was all like saying
it was breaking lower risk.
I want to hear the pros and positives why residential is lower risk.
Okay, so we've got a pool of 30% investors in the residential space. There is also a 70% pool of all of these owner occupiers that want to buy a house as well. So whenever you need to sell, there is going to be a market for it. If you need to sell an industrial shed, there's not always a market for it. There's a much smaller pool of buyers because 30% of them are only, 100% of them are only investors. And that is a small pool, as Steve alluded to earlier. Everyone doesn't understand the risks associated with commercial. So residential is a far better de-risk selection as well. So, and you just got to buy smart, right? If you can buy under market value, buy something that has capital value built into it, but also has some value added in the future. Like right now, after I jump off this call, I'm going to go buy a property that has potential for a granny flat on the back. We are buying it for $630,000. One up the road just sold for $880,000. We're going to put a $200,000 granny flat on it, and that's going to yield us $1,000 a week. And one up the road sold for $880,000. So we are getting paid $50,000 in capital value for owning that property. So we're generating value, we're generating income, and it's going to be cash flow neutral, cash flow positive. So if something does go wrong, we can just sell it. It's a cash cow, but again, different strategies as well. We have owner occupier market as well. Why do they call them granny flats? They're for granny. They're for family. So, yes, there is still strategies that you can do in residential space, but it is far less risky. It's far bigger market. That is it. And there's less capital value if something goes wrong. What breaks in a house? Not as much. It's same, you know, an air conditioner, a water system. You can get roof problems.
You can get every problem, Joe. A whole house. Can be wrong. Andrew's going to hate me for saying this, but like one of the points with residential is there are so many websites and data like that you can actually analyze. Like you can very simply look up in a certain suburb what the days on market average are for a 3-bedroom house. Whereas with commercial, besides your website, CP Data, Andrew, there is nothing. You have to do grunt work. You have to go on like CoreLogic and find when it went online, how long it was there for, how long the sales leasing campaign was. So there is that level of complexity there. Not hard, Joe. Just another step that you have to do to check.
Yep. I agree.
I would actually say that makes it more fun, Steve. And that actually is part of the benefits of commercial property. And I'm not going either way here. I'm just saying if it's harder to do, less people will do it. So you have more opportunity if you're willing to take the work and do the work. That's with any investment.
Yeah. I agree. Residential's boring. Joe's boring. He loses.
I don't do investing for fun. I don't have fun investing. I do it to make money.
Making money is fun, mate.
Says the guy running a Facebook group with 67,000 people or whatever. Just make that your new logo, yeah. Joe. I don't do this for fun.
I don't do fun. Well, I don't have fun in property.
When I used to work in retail, when I was packing shelves out the back in the dock, it used to say above the door, if you're having fun, you're not working.
That'll kill the spirit.
Yeah.
All right.
The one we had was, if you've got time to lean, you've got time to clean.
Yep. I like that. McDonald's, the founder, great movie. So I think what's actually happening now is that because Steve's going first every time, Joe's argument is just rebutting Steve's pros. So I'm going to flip this up and make Joe go first for this one. And the next topic is cash flow, the potential.
Well, commercial, just look at the numbers. Commercial is a far better cash flowing vehicle as opposed to residential. That is just hands down what it is. You should not be, please do not go out there and look at residential expecting the same cash flow returns that you can get from commercial because it's just not there. They will be there. You'll go to a mining town and you get 8%, 9%, 10%, but you also have to look at if it's a gross yield and a net yield, which is exactly what Steve's going to say. He's like, well, your yields are just gross. That doesn't factor in all the expenses. So there is a big difference. And that would be something worthwhile speaking to as well, Steve, the difference between gross and net. But cash flow wise, you can increase the capital value of your property and then increase the cash flow as well. So there are ways to make it easier on yourself. But if you do own 4 investment properties that are negative 20 grand, 20 grand, 20 grand, 20 grand, how long can you sustain that? So you need to get creative with some strategies and in your purchasing to get properties that kind of balance themselves out. So you have to, otherwise you won't be able to afford it. And really the ultimate goal is to build capital wealth. So if I'm losing $20,000 in or $10,000 in a year, I want to see a capital value increasing beyond that. So then I get negative gearing benefits. I also get depreciation benefits. If I've got that, these things are still a benefit of commercial, but you can still change your dwelling to get a better cash flow. I'm looking at another deal that is got potential to turn it into a rooming house, right? That then gives you far better returns from a cash flow perspective. Not that everyone's going to do that, but you can increase cash flow from there. But yeah, residential is not a cash cow. It is not a cash cow machine. It is to grow you big enough to be able to take a seat at the commercial table so that you have the capital to then transition that capital into commercial where you will get a far better retirement return outside of Resi.
Yeah. Even I'm going to give you a bit of charity here, Joe, but like even with residential, like you can have exit strategies that involve things like granny flats. So for instance, we just ran with a client, it was $190,000 for a granny flat in Brisbane and he rents it out for $450,000. So if you've got 2 or 3 of those, you can have that as your exit strategy. However, you're still shooting yourself in the foot to lending, which is one of the later topics, but you can kind of work that. The argument I'd say you would also make is having a commercial that's completely vacant is terrible cash flow. It is literally negative because you're covering the council rates and water rates while there's no tenant there. That's the risk of making sure you always get a tenanted one with a long lease that's versatile, low vacancy rates, and kind of just long-term kind of mindset. But for my argument, you've said it at the start, commercial 2 to 3 times the cash flow, far better performer, No need. I win this round. Move on.
Stop helping each other, guys. You're supposed to be trying to kill each other. Die for your argument. Die for it. All right, I'm going to throw Joe a lifeline because I am the only impartial person that's supposed to be here. Steve, if I pay down 30 or 40% of, like have a 30 or 40% deposit on a residential property, wouldn't I get similar cash flows to commercial property? Doesn't commercial property cash flow because of the large deposit you put down?
Yes and no. So yes, if you pay down extra, are you saying if you've got a 65% LVR on both of them?
Same.
Yep. So the cash flow is still 2 to 3 times as much because with the residential, you've got council rates, water rates, maintenance, like even a 6% gross yielding asset, which Joe mentioned before, like that's really tough in this market. Like you pretty much can't get that unless you go regional, like a Townsville or something like that. That erodes to probably closer to a 3-3.5%. So if I get a 6% net, I'm getting twice as much and I'm choosing a high risk, high yielding residential. But you are somewhat right. But the extra leverage later on, if you do get the capital growth and the rental increases, that scales extra as well because you've got more leverage. So your actual return on investment might actually change. So I'd kind of flip your argument, not say look at the cash flow. Your ROI potentially can be better on residential if you're more leveraged and the assumptions of the capital growth and rental increases actually happen.
And so why is a residential return a gross return and a commercial property is a net return?
With commercial, we've mentioned on some other podcasts, the tenants pay 100% of the outgoings. They pay council rates, maintenance, water rates, just managing the property even. So I'd say about half the deals we're looking at, property management's included as well. So like residential, that's 7-8% of your rent gone. So basically that's why it's net. So we look at what money's going to hit our account with all the other expenses. There are things called gross leases, but we'd still work out what the net rent is and present it as a net yield that way. But for me, that's low risk as well. So coming back to one of the other points, residential, you don't know what's going to break. So you kind of have to have the buffers for it. But while you've got a tenant, if I've got a 5-year lease, I don't have to worry about the air conditioner breaking in 2.5 years. I have to worry about the tenant still being there in 2.5 years, but I don't have to worry about the maintenance of that property.
But what happens when, you know, the other challenge is when that stuff, when you have a vacancy in a year's time, right, where you haven't saved that 5-year capital base, you do have to have larger buffers in place. So not only do you have to have more capital to get in, if someone said to you, I've got $250,000, you're not going to say, let's go buy a $250,000 property. No, you need far more buffers to make sure that when something goes wrong, like a vacancy, which is going to take 1, 2, 3, 6 months, you're going to be in a world of hurt.
I agree. So this is the whole reason why you have the buffers in place, but you can build those buffers much quicker with commercial because of the positive cash flow. Whereas residential, you're relying on paying the mortgage plus saving some money for the buffers. So there's a bit more, I'd argue, a staged approach with commercial where you need to be aware of when leases are finishing. And that's like for our clients, like we won't buy stuff like 3 properties that all have a lease finishing in 2026. You try to stage at 26, 27, 28. So they don't have 3 all end at the same time. Some commercials you got to be careful of. So like if you're looking at like refrigeration type warehouses, that you need to be very careful that they're keeping like the maintenance schedules on it. Because if they leave and the refrigeration doesn't work, you're then responsible for it. And that's not like replacing a, I don't know, like a $3,000, $4,000 residential one. Like that can be $20,000 to $100,000 depending on how big it is. So again, another layer of complexity, not hard. You just need to be aware.
All right. So I'm going to throw Joe another lifeline. I'm going to start prodding Steve again. So mate, in the situation where you're using equity on a property from another property to buy a commercial property, and we're using a deposit that has interest associated with it, and then we're going to buy another property. So essentially we're 100% financed. If we use that situation for commercial property and residential property, why would I go down the commercial route if essentially I'm 100% financed? It's not going to cash flow because I might be getting a 6% return, but the interest rate could be like high 6s or 7% on that commercial property. Why would I go commercial when I'm using 100% finance? Because this does happen a lot.
Yep, it does. But that's also one of the benefits of commercial is it's actually easier to hold that property even with 100% finance. So let's just say I get a 6% yield and the interest rate's 7%. I've only got that difference of 1%. Whereas with residential, if I go get 100% loan and like we just mentioned, like the net might be 2-2.5% net and interest rates, let's say they're percent lower. Let's say they're 6%. I'm actually making up 3.5% out of my own back pocket. So one's 1%, one's 3.5%. I've actually got 3.5 times more money I've got to put into the investment to hold it, which is what I was saying before about risk. If you can actually reduce the risk by having better cash flow on a commercial.
Okay, okay. Joe, any response to that?
Are we talking about finance?
No, no. I was just prodding Steve just because he's about the cash flow, because it was a cash flow thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the whole point of commercial is cash flow. So if you're lending into it and you can't, it's not giving you any cash flow, then you're not paying down the debt and you're just going to kind of accumulate debt. So you need to somehow figure out a way to make capital value to be able to afford that cash flow. Because if you're at 100% lending, then it's gonna be negative for you. Well, it might be negative for you at a 4-5% net yield. So yeah, you've got to create value to be able to release that value into a different type of asset like commercial. So I would say, yeah, if you leverage into a residential at 100% LVR, you can do things to increase the value, but also increase the cash flow, which then makes it, you know, less of a burden on you.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, but you can definitely still do it in commercial. So anything you can do in residential, Joe, I can do better in commercial. So I can change. Yeah, Lane, we've done a whole episode on value add opportunities. Like I can buy a residential that's the GP clinic or put a GP clinic into a residential property and it's worth more than your residential. So I can still fabricate that. I can still do all the types of renovations, subdivisions, extra dwellings that you can do, but I can do extra things. I can inflate rent. I can change the tenant. I can put telecommunications on top. I can put ATM machines. I can subdivide the tenancies where you get a higher square meter rate. So anything that you can do, I can also do, but I've actually got way more options. And Andrew, please do not start talking about self-storage.
But also you need a level of sophistication to be able to do that. You can't just step in and say, you know what, I'm going to chuck an ATM in. You're going to have to do that. Communication towers, do you just call up Optus and say, hey, guys, my phone plan's been cutting out. I reckon I need a tower on top of the roof of my commercial. So you've got to have a pretty in-depth level of sophistication to be able to do that. But yes, I agree. You can get a little bit more creative and you can add value in commercial
If only there was a book that explained it all simply, Joe.
Well, if you use the code OzProp, you get it for free. Don't pay for it. I was at the airport and they wanted $30.
$30.
I actually think it's $34.95.
Classic. All right, so we've already kind of touched on it, but the next topic was capital growth. What is the potential? Where's the better capital growth come from? So, Joe, I'm going to let you jump in here, mate, and plead the case for residential property capital growth.
Residential property has grown on average 6.9% over the last 20 years. That is a lot of value. That is doubling every 7 to 10 years. Obviously, you need to choose the right property and the right location to be able to get that. And it doesn't happen in 7 to 10 years. It happens in a period of 3 to 4 where the property gets a lot of value and then it stagnates and then it sits. So that's how it gets to that number over a 7 to 10 year period. Residential property is for capital growth. That is what it's there for. Don't trick yourself in trying to get these little lower value ones that aren't going to give you that capital growth. Not saying that I don't buy $400,000, $500,000 properties. I absolutely do. They have got a lot of value. It just allows you, because it's about getting the asset that's the perfect fit for you. So if you can't afford a negative cash flow of $30,000 for a year, great. You need to go to the next best growth location that is going to give you that $10,000 a negative or that $5,000 negative cash flow and make it happen for yourself. So you do have to shift around, but for capital growth, the numbers are there. You need a small deposit. You can get in easy. You don't need $1 billion to get started on your portfolio, and then you can compound and grow that value and retire eventually.
A billy. I like it. Stevie, your turn.
So we sort of alluded to it before, like commercial gets the exact same capital growth. The hard part is it's actually harder to analyze, because like a retail shop grows different to a warehouse, which grows different to an office space. And even like if you've got two retail complexes 500 meters away from each other, they'll have different foot traffic, road traffic, demand, capital growth things. So it is that layer of complexity which Joe will counter argue. But you still get the capital growth. You don't have a $500,000 house next to a $500,000 warehouse on the same size land component. The house goes to $1 million and then that warehouse stay at $500,000, because everyone in the house is going to be looking at the warehouse being like, I want to buy this. It rents for 3 times as much. And then they actually happen out of sync, which is where one of the misconceptions comes from. that you don't get the capital growth, because while resi's growing, like Joe mentioned, over a 4 or 5 year period, commercial in some instances, not in the last 4 or 5 years, but in some instances, won't grow. And they go, oh, look at all these idiots buying commercial, they don't have capital growth. But then while they're not having capital growth, from like Sydney 2004 to 2011, commercial was growing and they're not talking about it. So it's getting things, you still have to bite on the fundamentals. So funnily enough, the residential market is actually a fundamental. So if there's really high demand for residential, there's typically going to be high demand for commercial, because you still need car mechanics, wholesalers, spray painters, fabricators, self-storage, Andrew, e-distribution centers, all that type of stuff. They kind of work hand in hand. But Joe's also mentioned like the economy plays a part of it as well. And you've got to match up the supply versus demand, but it all comes down to land. Like that's the only finite resource. So you still need a land component. But to closing statement, you will get the exact same capital growth, if not more, if you understand demand.
Joe, anything to say on that?
So I guess the question is, you look at some commercial properties and they do not keep pace with the capital growth that you see in the residential space. So I'm not entirely sure that it does keep pace the same as residential. Otherwise, why would people not be loving the commercial? Why is there not this massive pool of residential is 20% investors, 30% investors? Why is it not smaller percentage? And why aren't residential people all just going into the capital growth and cash flow?
So in short, Steve, Joe's calling bullshit. That's it. So come on, sick him.
I actually disagree with that. And I wholeheartedly disagree with that. And I can't back it up with numbers, but like 5 years ago, there was nothing on commercial property to actually understand it. Like it was a little bespoke, like wealthy person thing. But now that that actually is changing, like, and I can see it from, there's other buyer's agents kind of buying lots of properties and there's more mom and dad investors. 5 years ago, if I mentioned to someone on a sales call commercial, they were completely clueless. And now there's multiple podcast series, multiple books on the market, multiple buyer's agents. So I actually would like to actually see those numbers. And I actually think you'll see a shift. You'll see a growth of, I'm going to make up a number here, 1% of the market buying commercial, and it might be 2 or 3% right now. So I'm going to do some digging after this and see if I can come up with some numbers for you, Joe.
That's don't lie. Yeah,
well, there's no like doubt in people's mind that residential property is a capital growth play. That's the main way that people
should
make money in residential property. Residential property has made more millionaires than any other asset class, and that's through capital growth. So I think Joe does have to take out this particular topic, because it's essentially what the asset class is built to do.
One of the points I want to make out there, and Joe will agree with me on this, is you get a lot of residential investors talking about they're buying a cash flow property residential, which for me is just ridiculous. Like they're talking about like, oh, I'm buying this residential property and it's $100 a week positive. I'm like, cool, you made $5,000 kind of thing. And then your air conditioner blow up and it's kind of gone. And that's where the negative, like the argument comes from, negative gearing to positive cash flow. But that's where kind of commercial blows it out of the water, because you're actually talking about a proper cash flow. And Joe would have this all the times with his clients, I imagine, with residential, of like, oh, I want it neutrally geared instead of negative. And it's the wrong way to look at it. It is a capital growth play. That is why you're buying it.
Good stuff. Agreed. Good stuff.
I agree. All right. And I'm glad to see the refs on my side now as well.
I'm impartial. I'm giving you both lifelines, trying to keep this as fair as possible. All right, let's go to the next topic, guys. I'm going to stick with Joe, and we're going to go with the finance and lending. Do you ever hit your glass ceiling? How hard is it to get lending on residential property?
Residential lending is the easiest. Literally, it is the easiest form of lending that you can get. You can even pretend to be an owner-occupier and just get a normal house loan. So interest rate might be even a little bit lower if you get creative on those type of things. Not that we recommend doing that, but there are far more lenders. There's, 50, 60 people in a loan book for a broker that can lend out money to you. So what does that mean? Well, it means there's competition within that loan book of 50, 60 lenders. I'm sure there's far more. In the commercial space, I don't know, Steve, what's the answer to how many lenders that can lend in the commercial space? That's
The major lenders still doing it. There's also some commercial only lenders like the think tanks and things like that, but I'll let you keep going. You are right. You typically pay an extra percent or so for commercial lending.
Oh, so it's not even the limited access to lenders. It's also you're paying a far higher interest rate.
Can be. Yeah. Good point.
There's also government incentives from the lending perspective as well. That's one of the choices. You get your first home buyer's grant. You don't have to pay stamp duty. Different states, different rules, different free money. But that is free money from the government to give you that. So you've got government incentives, easy to qualify for a loan. So lenders have a lot less stringent criteria. They will let you get a loan. I'm sure you're going to have some arguments with that as well on the commercial side of things. You can, however, hit a glass ceiling. We have a debt to income ratio, which is what it sounds like, debt to how much income that you have. It's kind of generally around that 6 to 7 times income. So once you get more debt than your income in the residential space, you start to tap out with lending. So that is one of the challenges that you're going to face with residential property. However, you can have a fantastic conversation with combining your accountant and your mortgage broker and you can your lawyer as well, talking about trust structures where you can put property inside a trust, which will then essentially hide it from the lending capacity to allow you to borrow to buy more property. Now, not financial advice, speak to your qualified professional. There may be those options out there. Also, lending is done on a 30-year amortization. A lot of commercial, you can do that, but sometimes it's 10, 15, 20 years. So that means a lot more capital up front as well. And lower down payments, you don't have to pay so much. You don't need $100,000 to get into a residential. You can get in with $60,000. So from a lending perspective, it's far easier. It's far better. You don't need a billion documents to be able to get the broker to go through it, unlike you do in some of the commercial space.
Uh-huh. Good arguments. And I actually agree with Joe. It is simpler, but I'm not trying to argue what's simple. I'm trying to argue what makes more money for people. And that's why they buy. And not everyone's a simpleton like Joe. So I'm going to talk to the more astute kind of listeners. You don't hit the glass ceiling with commercial lending because they service themselves better. And you've also got additional options. So yes, you might have a few more lenders, but you've got lease doc loans and no doc loans where you can keep pushing the envelope and effectively keep buying. So even though Joe's arguments previously were, I can accumulate faster at the start, he can't accumulate faster at the end. So we're pushing that end goal back based on someone's income. Whereas commercial, for the mum and dad clients, your battler clients that you were saying before, we can actually keep going and actually build them a bigger portfolio at the back end, not just the front end.
Anything to say, Joe? You look bamboozled.
I don't feel bamboozled. All you've told me is it's more expensive, it's harder to get access to, it's far more paperwork, you've got all these silly options with different things. I just want to buy a property that's going to grow in value and give me a good return. Oh, mate, you've made it difficult. Why does it have to be so hard?
And then stop after 2 or 3 and enjoy your 20 grand positive retirement.
But we'll talk to exit strategies, and that is going to change some things up.
So one thing I do want to ask Joe is that, did you know that there are stamp duty concessions for commercial property in some states where you don't have to pay stamp duty at all?
Australia. Yes. And yeah, there are. You can get stamp duty. WA?
ACT.
ACT.
And so
I knew that. I listened to the podcast, so
obviously.
So, Steve, do you think that the stamp duty concessions for Resi stack up to not having to pay stamp duty at all for some states in commercial? Like, obviously, the stamp duty in Resi, the first home buyer's grant, things like that, they're really awesome. Like, I took advantage of that when I bought my first principal place of residence. I think it worked out to be about $30,000 or $40,000 or something I saved. Give me some argument why commercial is better or not.
So again, not financial advice, but I actually think those concessions are traps. They're actually to push people into buying things, like you mentioned before, Andrew, to be locked in for the next 20, 30 years. And I've actually heard you say on this podcast that one of your biggest regrets was buying a principal place of residence because it's held you back from your investing and making money that way. So a lot of the times those concessions, they're not actually for the buyer. They're for the developers and the government and anyone just to get basically tax. They want stamp duties. They want people paying tax. They want workers. So I actually would argue those concessions. But in saying that, though, with the stamp duty one, I never encourage people to buy based on a tax incentive. Like, it's a consideration, but it shouldn't be the main purpose. And what we actually find in Adelaide and Canberra, for instance, when we are buying commercials there, even though there's no stamp duty, the yields are softer anyway. So that kind of makes up some of the difference over the long term.
Yeah, it balances itself out for that risk return that we were talking about before.
He's got me there, Joe. I was going into bat for you, mate, but he's good. He's good. He's been listening. All right, so I'll move on to the next topic, which is exit strategies. Who wants to take this one first?
Well, I got a question for Steve. What owner-occupier, you need to sell your place, you need to get it done. How many owner-occupiers are going to buy your shed?
How many owner-occupiers? Lots. There's some markets where there's more demand for owner-occupier industrial properties than there are investors because there's so many workers in the area that own businesses that can't get a space. So their next step is actually buy a space to be locked in so they don't get kicked out. And again, this is the hard part with commercial because you can't just look up data easily on a website and find out like percentage of owner-occupier purchases to actually. So you actually have to do the grunt work with that and talk to real estate agents, look on CoreLogic, try to assess the market. So it is more complicated there. But going into exit strategies, it just depends on what we come back before of like what you're actually trying to achieve. So yes, residential will work really well if you want a very simple retirement in 20 or 30 years time where let's just say with your strategy, Joe, you're going to buy three residential properties and you're going to pay them off over 20, 30 years. You can then, you've effectively like with the market, you've got three sets of rent that are giving you your lifestyle to actually be able to get that and live. And even if you sell your place and you've got three rents, you could rent somewhere three times as nice and effectively be in a neutral cash flow position. However, as we've mentioned before with the cash flow, commercial, we're two to three times as much. So we can either do it in two or three times less time or with two to three times less portfolio. So it's balancing up that. But commercial for me, like that is why you buy. It is actually a substantial passive income that you actually can enjoy life with.
Yeah, and exiting in the residential space is with capital value. You are building a portfolio over time to increase the capital value. Having four places at $500,000 that have doubled in 10 years, you can then sell down all four of those and then you've then got millions of dollars ready to go that you can utilize and put it wherever you want. I wouldn't say the smart money is in commercial property to put that capital. I would say you would probably want to transition that into an asset that's going to give you a net return on your money. The rebuttal I have is that you haven't got such a big pool. I can sell to home buyers. I can sell to investors. I can sell to a REIT if I wanted to. I can sell to people that need, I can sell to government housing, depending on the property. So there's far more easier ways out. I don't have to worry. Like we said at the beginning, let's just say something happened in my situation and I need to get my $500,000 out of that property in the next week. Literally, I could call up a bunch of agents, guys, I need to sell this quick. I need to sell it fast. I need someone to buy it tomorrow. Great. That can happen. They can call that. I get those type of calls all the time. Hey, Joe, you need to be quick on this one. It's 450,000. I do the numbers. It's valued at 500,000. Great. I'll take it because people can get out quickly in the residential space. In the commercial space, it's just not as quick and not as efficient as that.
My counter argument to that is with commercial, you don't need to get out. It's an asset that's giving you lots of cash flow. So you can use that money. You don't have to sell and pay like you, because if you're not selling, you're not paying capital gains. You're not losing the stamp duty that you paid on it. It actually gives you that lifestyle. And that's where planning. Me and you have done a podcast previously on your forums, Joe, where we actually went over like the seven different exit strategies and the pros and the cons. So it's just what you're actually trying to achieve that way. And like without sounding arrogant, like, and I know you're going to use this to get against me, but like I'm selling my residential properties at the moment and transitioning into commercial. And even though because of the lower LVRs, I'm actually less wealthy in terms of net wealth because my portfolio is smaller, but my passive income's larger. No one actually cares if I've got a $4 million portfolio or a $10 million portfolio. I care whether I've got a $200,000 passive income or a $300,000 passive income because that's what gives me my lifestyle. I can travel around the world, fly business class, stay in nice hotels. And that's where you're going to say, well, look what residential did for you, Steve.
Yep, you're welcome. You're welcome. Residential gave you that. It's given you that lifestyle. It's allowed you to do that along with a thriving commercial property buyer's agency that definitely helps.
In saying that though, I also regret not buying commercial sooner in my portfolio, but that was because of lack of education because it wasn't out there at the time.
So you would have bought it sooner. You would have gone.
Yep, I would have bought commercial sooner because I was started because obviously with serviceability, I was getting capped out at 80%. And there was 80% lend options. So with my arguments over this podcast of I get better cash flow, I get the same capital growth, it would have actually ended up in a better result. Still not a bad result owning kind of like the 8 or 9 residentials, but I should have started sooner when my LVR had to start dropping based on my risk profile.
All right, all right. I don't really have too much to rebut against that, and I think you guys have really covered it. So I want to move on to the last and final topic to debate, which is scalability. Steve, because Joe had the first crack at the last topic, you can go first on this one.
Yeah, okay. So I think we've kind of covered this already, so I'll kind of summarize. You can get there much quicker with commercial because of the cash flow. Assuming your goal is a passive income, if Joe's going to say, if your goal is net wealth, then yes, he is actually right. And I'll let him win this round. You can build more net wealth with leverage early on with residential. But if your goal is actually cash flow, you can get there quicker with commercial. And in regards to your question on scalability, because we don't have that glass ceiling with lending, we can actually keep going. So even if your eyes are bigger and you do want to build that net wealth later on, commercial can give you that back end growth.
Yeah, I agree. What this is working out for me on this conversation is it's a time thing. It's what, going back to what is the assets and resources that you have, where are you looking to go, and what is the next asset that you need to acquire that's going to allow you to get there? Because at the end of the day, everybody's end goal is a passive income. I don't want to die with $10 million worth of capital assets that's giving me $0 in cash return. Why the hell would you want that? It's just a silly number on a spreadsheet. What I want is exactly that cash flow return. So it really comes down to what time frame are you at? How long are you going to invest for? What capital resources do you have so that you can get to this point as fast as possible? And for me, that includes doing something. So we have like three phases. We have an accumulation phase. We then have an adjustment phase where we can start to turn onto our portfolio and do things like renovations, subdivisions, developments. Like I bought a corner block, split it down the middle, went into three. That gave me $100,000 of capital to then go invest in another property. And then the third phase is your cash flow, which is when you're transitioning this existing portfolio into something exactly like what Steve is doing right now. Because all Steve cares about is, I have, let's just say, $5 million here. I want my $5 million to give me a 7% return. Now, I didn't prepare the numbers on that. So what is that? 7% return is $350,000 of net income per year. So I'm going to have 350 grand and that's all Steve cares about. That's all I care about. And it's just going to come down to where are you in your portfolio right now and what do you need to get you to that next level?
Yeah, spot on, Joe. But everyone's actually different. Like I've actually had some clients where they come and I actually convince them to buy residential because part of their exit strategy, they're selfless. They're actually not caring about cash flow. Like a lot of like mum and dad clients want to own properties for their kids so they can pass it on to their kids so they don't feel like they're out of the market. And in that circumstance, you might actually argue, look, let's buy the area that you want them because at least you're never going to be priced out of that market. Whereas if you go and buy in Perth or something like that, and Perth does terribly compared to where they live, for instance, or it might do better, but at least they're in that market. But their strategy is not cash flow. Their strategy is have a roof over their kids' heads, each individually, and that's why they buy. So that's what we're saying, what they're trying to actually achieve and what time frame and what the end goal is.
Well, I like Joe's argument there. It was very convincing. And also, Steve also had a very good convincing argument, which actually supported Joe's argument as well. That was almost like our final argument.
It's called jiu-jitsu. This is not boxing.
Joe just bait and switch, jiu-jitsu. Or something like that. So.
I'm just tired, Andrew. It's the 10th round. I'm hanging up him on the ropes.
All right. So because they've basically already answered the closing arguments in the final topic, we're not going to do another closing argument segment. But what we do have now is the secret question. And I don't know if I should get one of them to leave the room so the other one can't just copy or rebut the answer. All right, I'll ask Stevie first because I already know his answer, I think. But Joe, cover your ears if you can. All right, so the question is, if you could only buy one asset type for the rest of your life, for whatever reason, you're just not allowed to buy both. You can only buy one. Which one would you choose to suit your lifestyle?
Easy, commercial. I'm not an idiot like Joe.
Now, this is where it gets interesting because I'm going to ask the Resonator, Joe the Mo the Resonator, the same secret question. Well, now he knows it because he's heard me take it to Steve, but they didn't know I was going to ask this question. So, Joe, this is where you could be ousted from the closet as a commercial lover. So, mate, same question. You could only choose one asset class that you could buy for the rest of your life. Which one would you choose?
where I am right now financially in my life, I would be going for commercial because that's going to give me the cash flow that I require. Now, I'm in a very, very different situation to a lot of other people. So I can have a lot of lending situations. I can open up other different trusts and structures to allow me to go ahead and buy. But if I was Joe 5 years ago, I think I would be very happy with 4 residential purchases, each with a granny flat on the back that is going to give me $1,000 a week. And over the next 20 years, it's going to pay themselves off. And I'm going to individually have $4,000 a week, which is times by 52, is going to give me $208,000 after expenses. We're going to be in with 150 cash flow, which is more than my salary would have been. So, you know, it just depends situationally.
I'm actually going to back you up here, Joe. So if Andrew asked me before I had any properties, I actually would say residential because like you mentioned and probably won the round, the barrier to entry is much less. I bought my first property with about 30 grand. So for me to have saved like 200 grand to get into a commercial, instead of buying at age 21, it would have been like 26, 28. And I would have missed out on 300, 400 grand of capital growth to then be able to get into another one. So I actually think time was on my side then and the barrier entry was lower. So if he asked me when I was 20 years old, residential 100%. If you've got good capital and savings, commercial.
You guys are supposed to be murdering each other.
What about you, Andrew?
You're just hugging it out.
What about you?
Agreeing, like, this isn't a debate. This is like, this is just a hug fest.
All right, so at the end of a fight.
It comes down to my decision. Who do I think has the most convincing case? Is it Joe the Mo Tucker, a.k.a. the Resonator, or the Ibis, a.k.a. the Bearded Bin Chicken? And both have had very convincing arguments. Joe, I do have to tip your hat to you slightly because you did stay in character a lot more and you didn't give Steve anything. Stevie, you obviously went a little bit outside of your character, but had very, very good arguments as well. And my decision really comes down to there is no right decision. Both residential and commercial property are great investments, and it belongs to you as a person when you should make that choice. Residential is a great tool for when you're young, you have limited capital to grow and build a portfolio to potentially buy a better investment grade asset, which commercial property is for creating lifestyle. So the only way that I can judge this as it's a tie, let's hug it out. Sunshine and rainbows. Let's all kiss and hug and buy lots of property together.
No, these judges
now
are
you're
so
calling
rude.
Me soft yeah. after yeah. you.
Bloody,
you.
There's always a winner at the end of a fight. Always a winner.
You're dead to me, Andrew. Dead to me.
Well, the real answer is going to be in the comments. Anyone, we read all the comments that go through here. So anyone that throws in a comment, we will tally it up after a couple of weeks. After 1 month, 4 weeks, we will tally up the response and see who won. I do, however, feel I need a little bit of residential help because this is commercial property investing explained and there might be some bias. So any residential people that are listening, back me up here, help a brother out.
Awesome, guys. Well, this has been Steve Polisi, Joe Tucker, and Andrew Bean on the Commercial Property and Residential Explained Simply series. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening to the Commercial Property Investing Explained series. This show has been produced by the Commercial Property Show Network.